Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation related. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. Today, we're going to be speaking with Eric Pregler all about performance testing in a new context with VMs and cloud-based technology, and also how to really do a better job at reporting test results to our end users of our performance test. Also, just a heads up, I just heard from Dave Hefner from episode 2 that he's rolling out an updated edition of his book, The Selenium Guidebook. So make sure to check him out at theseleniumguidebook.com. I'll also have that link within the show notes. I know he's doing a lot of updates. He has a Ruby version and a Java version, and I think he's going to slowly roll out versions of his book for every single language binding that Selenium supports. So definitely check him out. Before we get into our interview with Eric, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section. Hey, Eric. Welcome to Test Talks.
Hi, Joe. Good to be here.
Cool. Before we get into it, could you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Okay. I am a performance tester by background, or at least for the last 15 years. I started working in software about 20 years ago. I moved from development to testing in 99, and I did some functional test leadership, started to do a little automation, then moved to performance full-time in 2002, 2003, and that's the space I've been in since then. Today, I work for a testing tool startup called Sosta, and I do a little independent work on the site as well.
Awesome. So today, I'd like to talk about your presentations at Ordev. You had one on performance testing in a new context and interpreting and reporting performance test results. And I was able to actually sit in on the reporting performance testing results one, and I really enjoyed it. And to me, I've always said for some reason, creating the scripts for performance tests are usually easier than actually interpreting the results. So why did you feel like you had to put together this presentation on reporting performance test results?
Oh, well, first of all, if you like the scripting better, then we should work together.
Okay.
Well, because my opinion about a performance test project is that there are a couple of phases to it. And, you know, coming up with a plausible simulation is a big part of that. And then coding that is, you know, another part of it. But when you actually interpret what you learn from your experiment, and then turn that into something actionable, I think that's a really key part of the process. In the performance testing world, we talk about tool jockeys, about people who can do scripting but don't understand what it means, can't put it in the context of something that the business can make a decision on. That's sort of taking a interesting engineering exercise and turning it into something that has an impact on what the business does.
Awesome. So I'm actually an old school performance test engineer, and I haven't done much with it, you know, in some years. So how has performance testing tools and approaches changed in the last few years? I know you cover this in your other presentation. I'm just curious to know, like with virtualization and the cloud, how have you seen things evolved in the performance space over the, I guess, 15 plus years you've been involved with performance testing?
Well, they've evolved a lot. So when I first learned how to performance test, the VP of QA at the time was familiar with the CompuWare sales rep. So I got a tool called QA Load put in my hands.
Nice.
And then with a year or two, I managed to trade that in for Load Runner. So that's where I got started, is the old school client server load tool type model. And those solved a need going back to the 90s that was what was there at the time. And there's still some pretty good tools out there, and I've used most of them in the consulting practice between back then and now. But these days, if you're talking about a SaaS application or you're talking about a public-facing website, the users go from the hundreds concurrently to the thousands or tens of thousands. And that change in application architecture also requires some change in how load injectors work. We're able to go from what was a couple hundred virtual users per box to a couple thousand per box these days, but it's just still not practical to manage a couple dozen boxes to get together a load against the system, particularly if you want to run load from different geographical locations, which is another requirement that I certainly see a lot more of now than I used to.
Since we're able to scale up almost to infinity when we use cloud solutions, why do we even need to still do performance testing? Back in the day, we just say throw hardware at it, and this is like actually the ultimate dream, I think, is just scale up. It's infinite. So why do we still need to do performance testing?
Well, because it isn't just hardware. I mean, you know, the hardware is what the hardware is, and it's the promise of cloud and elastic resources, I think, has been largely met in that whatever machine resources are needed, we can continue to scale horizontally. But there's still the code that runs on top of it, the part we actually have control over. There's soft resources involved, like the size of a database connection pool or the number of sessions that you can hold in memory on a single server. There's still all of these things to check against and to test for, even when it appears that the pool of resources is bottomless. And by the way, I'm just letting that pass for now, but my experience is not that the resources are bottomless.
So in this new context, then, you named a few resources, but are there any must-monitor resources you think everyone needs to be aware of nowadays that they should be monitoring that may not have been popular back in the day?
So network bandwidth is a little more key, I think, when you're talking about a distributed user base. The example we always use in troubleshooting here is the person who's connecting via their phone over Panera Wi-Fi at lunchtime, where network conditions are not fantastic. So paying attention to what the load is on the client end, and then also coming into your data center are key. You know, it's typical that you'll have provisioned some amount of bandwidth coming in, and then maybe you'll need to handle larger surges. So I'm seeing, I have 100 megabit line. Well, sometimes I need more. Well, that's okay. AT&T says it will burst to 1 gigabit a second when I need it. And then we test that. We find out that it doesn't respond as quickly as we might like. And even if you can describe a technical capability, that isn't the same thing as verifying it works as intended.
You mentioned earlier about geographically placed load generators. And back in the day, once again, I would have to load up software on a machine and ship it to like an office in one of our locations and then have them turn it on to run a script in something called Business Availability Center. So how is it done nowadays? You just point to a cluster in some location on Amazon and you're able to pretty much get that type of data?
How that works with cloud-based load injection depends on which tool that you're using. So I've used four tools that can use cloud-based load injection. Two of them are previous generation client-server tools, LoadRunner and NeoLoad. Two of them are cloud-only plays, BlazeMeter and Sosta. So for LoadRunner and NeoLoad, they have a system where there is a cloud-based injector that you would control with your conductor. Not to make too many digressions, but I'm also not talking about StormRunner right now, which is a different issue. Is the HP's new offering that's more like Sosta or BlazeMeter.
Yep.
So the traditional client server tools, I've not used the LoadRunner Cloud Injector. I have used the NeoLoad Cloud Injectors. There was a tokening system that you could rent them by the hour. There was some sizing work to do. But if you could get load injected from cloud locations. The cloud-based tools, they tend to provision the load injectors as needed. So with BlazeMeter, they kind of control that for you, and you can pick the Amazon region you want to run things in, and they have support for some other cloud providers. In the Sosta world, we have a couple of different providers we work with, primarily Amazon and Azure, but also HP, at least until those get turned off in a couple months, and IBM, GoGrid, and some local providers in Europe and Asia. So there's no load injector that exists until I push the button to create them. They cost something like 14 cents an hour per box. And then I push a button when I don't need them anymore, and then they get destroyed. The idea is that the cloud-based load tool handles the provisioning and installation of software for you and is on demand.
A lot of engineers, I think, I still hear this, not as often as I used to, but we need to test against a bare metal machine. But pretty much every organization now is using virtual machines. Have you seen that as something that someone that's coming from a background in performance testing that still isn't a hurdle they need to get over. It's just the fact of life now that we need to test against VMs.
Oh, I agree. It's just a fact of life. I mean, this is just the way that application architecture has changed. What I'm still seeing the old school load runner people who are balking at using virtualized load injectors and claiming that their instruments won't work correctly if they're virtualized. And there is some risk that you can virtualize incorrectly. But, I mean, this is just the world we live in now. Even the companies whose primary business isn't technology have virtualized virtually everything in their data center. And, you know, there are holdouts, there's legacy applications, and there's, you know, legacy engineers who haven't gotten with that. But I think that battle is over.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think in your presentation, you've been using VMs since 2004, I think. So in your experience, it doesn't cloud the performance results, does it?
It can. And this is always a concern. So when it's virtualized inside of somebody's private cloud, then I have to kind of depend on whoever did that virtualizing that they've provided enough resources to the pool. A load test is a perfectly designed approach for defeating a leveling algorithm, which is what the VMware vSphere uses to put virtual machines on the proper physical hardware. So the idea is you put stuff on vSphere, and you wait. After some period of time, it has sorted all the machines in a way to load balance their requirements onto the different physical nodes. Well, then a load test shows up and changes that and changes those equations. So I've definitely been in a situation where I've run out of resources at the virtualization layer and had my results be corrupted. I was able to tell that was occurring, though, because you should always monitor your injectors and because my response times were erratic under steady load.
So Eric, also, with all these servers kind of out of our hands now, they're in some other person's cloud. I used to be able to go to the admins of these machines and say, hey, I need your help. This is a team effort. What did you do here? Can you configure this? How do we handle this now in this new world where we don't necessarily own the servers that we're running our applications on?
It's difficult. It's kind of taking a step back to a previous level of sophistication in how I was able to do performance testing. Back to before resources were monitored. In my current context with the cloud-based load injectors, we do a lot of on-demand testing where a customer brings us in and says, you turn on the load, we'll do the monitoring. And so I'm working with an ops team that will tell me when they think a resource is being starved. At one point, I was able to give somebody a report that said, you're out of this resource and you need to scale this resource to get to, you know, whatever work level. And that's just gone now.
Yeah, I definitely agree. That's something that we still need to find better ways to maybe overcome that. But it's just the way of doing business now. So there's no way around it, unfortunately, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, again, this is just something that kind of already happened. And as testers, we are the tail and we're getting wagged at best, so that we don't get to tell people whether they should virtualize or not to solve our problems.
Absolutely. So talking about reporting, one thing I've noticed with newer tools, maybe, like I said, I haven't really done a lot with it, is back when I used a vendor-based tool, the reporting was really robust. I was able to create nice graphs and layer graphs on top of one another and do that kind of analysis for the performance information. But I don't see that with some of the open source tools. So do you have any suggestions on how we could create better graphs with all the type of performance information we're getting back from using our open source performance tools?
Okay, so acknowledging first that I do work for a tools vendor, and one of the differentiators I offer against open source is that we have that kind of functionality.
Oh, cool.
So that being said, my experience with the open source tools is it's not as bad as everybody thinks. It does take some work, and the first time you do it, it will seem frustrating if you're used to, I push a button and a graph appears. What I found is that using a tool like JMeter, that you can do some Excel graphing, I've even dumped a fairly large test results into Tableau and made some scatter charts with that. It's more work, but that's part of what you're paying for when you buy a commercial tool. I found that I haven't got to use the grinder on a real project yet, but the visualization it shows is not too bad. I'd consider showing that to somebody if it showed the right thing. The whole idea of reporting, I think people talk about graphs, but any report that I give to an executive is going to have two, maybe three graphs that have two or three data points on them, and then have a paragraph. I think I got this from Mike Kelly, who I don't know where he got it from. Every graph deserves a paragraph. Then there's a paragraph under the graph that says what you're looking at and what it means. And I don't use the graphs to try to tell a story as I do to try to support a narrative that the rest of my analysis has generated. I mean, you can't send somebody 50 graphs like the default tool report button will give you and expect them to understand what occurred. You have to explain it, especially if you work in performance testing, where most everybody you're going to talk to knows less about what you're doing than you do. So you need to be explicit about what you learned, what you saw, and what that tells you.
Awesome. That's a great point. That's actually one of the biggest points I really enjoyed about your presentation when you mentioned this, that you really need to put some context around a graph and just don't send graphs to people and assume they understand what it means. Because, like I said, it's to me, analyzing the results are sometimes the hardest piece of the performance test. So having that context, the paragraph, actually talking about what's going on rather than just sending it. And you have a nice slide there where you actually show a mock-up graph that explains it.
Well, right. And they're just the two or three graphs. It's a human psychology thing, I'm sure. But if I send somebody 20 graphs, that's less useful to them than if I send two. Because when I send them 20, I don't tell them what they need to focus on. So if I want to communicate something key to somebody, I mean, I have maybe an hour to present results and take questions. I probably have less. If I'm trying to do it in writing, like in a report, then I can communicate even less. So the idea then is not just, you know, to produce the right data, but it's to filter it down to the right size chunks that something can be done with them.
Awesome. So hopefully I'm not putting you on the spot, but you had a method that you used called Caviar that you actually went over when you're presenting results. Yeah, I thought that was really helpful, just having that acronym in the back of my head.
Okay, so Caviar came out of attempting to generate a pithy acronym for what it is we do after a test is complete and we turn results into actionable information. So there may be an extra A in there, but the idea was that generating data, a lot of data, is pretty easy to do once you've written the scripts and decided what you're going to simulate. And it was the thinning that out to the one little rich spoonful of what's really useful to the business stakeholder that made it appropriate. And I'm actually not a huge Caviar fan myself, but I've tried it, and one little scoop has so much flavor, and it's very satisfying, and you only need a little tiny bit because it's so rich. And that's sort of the idea with the Caviar process, is to get to that one little spoonful on one little toast point that you can hand to somebody and they can enjoy it, and then we can all get on with our lives.
Awesome. And I believe the acronym stood for collecting, aggregating, visualizing, interpreting, accessing, and reporting.
Yeah, I think you can guess what the extra A is, but that is definitely the process as described. And one of the important things is that there's no jumping to a conclusion. That's really easy to do when you've been performance testing for a while, is to look at results and then spit out root cause. And the danger in doing that is, A, you're often wrong, and you know only House MD is allowed to be wrong several times and get it right in the end, and everybody forgets. The rest of us who live in the real world have to watch our credibility. And the decisions that we're asking people to make based on our performance tests often represent a lot of money and time. And if we say you need to delay the launch of your e-commerce website by 3 weeks and fix these problems, and that could be an awful lot of money online. So to be able to speak to those sorts of requirements and to be able to report on results from our test and attest to what they mean, we have to protect that credibility carefully. So going through the process of I saw this, I saw this, I saw this, it might mean this thing. These are the things I can check to support that argument. Kind of like the scientific method, is going to be a lot easier to do. Partly because it helps you use safety language to talk about, well, it might mean this and it could be this, and it invites people to collaborate with you. If you say your database sucks, the DBA is not going to help you. If you say, we're seeing an increase in response time, and I see a corresponding increase in I/O latency on the database log volume, the DBA will push you out of the way to get in there and figure out what that means. And by presenting it as a finding instead of a conclusion, you've been able to enlist that person, and you've been trusted as a scientific instrument. instead of just somebody else who spouts off with what I call dart throwing troubleshooting, which is immensely frustrating if you're trying to get some help on something. And that's the approach is, oh, well, just check this and get back to me. And that's a bad way to troubleshoot. It's a really bad way to report on a performance test. So the idea with going through those steps is I figure out what I know, I figure out what it means, I figure out what that could represent. And then I'm able to negotiate with all the people involved in that performance test project, the subject matter experts, the business stakeholders. Okay, this seems to be happening. Let's work together to figure out what it means. And then that helps us get to the proper conclusion. And the SMEs are engaged. And they're going to be able to take the data that you provided and do something useful with it. If I tell the DBA, you know, your storage is slow, or your storage appears to be slow, is there anything we can do? I'm going to get an entirely different answer. And hopefully their engagement on how to fix it. Hopefully, if I can go talk to that DBA privately, what I present back to the business stakeholder is a completed plan of what the DBA is going to do before our next test.
No, that's great advice. And it's almost like you want to ask open-ended questions, because if you just pinpoint on something, you may derail the whole troubleshooting process. And usually a DBA probably knows a little bit more than the performance tester. Maybe not, but usually, like you said, doing an open-ended question or just not blaming them, getting their input, almost always leads to better results, I think, overall.
Sure, sure. And that's just the reality of things, is that there's a lot of focus, I think, in technology on being right and proving that your stuff works right and needing it to be proven to you that your stuff isn't right before you'll do anything. Yep. And it's good to just kind of sidestep that process and collaborate together. I mean, if I look at the most interesting stuff that's coming out of the Agile community, it's about safety. It's about people working together. I mean, that's the kind of things that really change. That really, in my experience, you have to have a successful technical project. If you have a bunch of big brains having a pissing match with each other, then you're usually not going to get anywhere until somebody calls an end to it and demands people work together.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, once again, back in the day, I would always run the same test at least 3 times and then get the average of those 3 tests. And now when I think about it, I don't even know if that was correct, because someone told me at one time you need statistical relevance, and just running a performance test once in time doesn't necessarily give you the picture of what's going on. So what's your approach to that? Do you run the same test multiple times, the same exact test in the same scenario, the same time, just to make sure you didn't have an anomaly when you first ran a test, if you got a weird result? Or is just having that anomaly something that you need to look into because it could be a potential issue?
Wow, that's a great question. Thanks for saving it for now. Let me take some time to answer it. So all models are wrong. Some are useful. A load test is going to be some model. We pretend that we're going to have this closed deterministic system where the resources available are always going to be the same, and the software is always going to be the same, and the way that a multi-user system responds to the flow of requests coming in will always be the same. And then we introduce randomness into the delays between the requests that we make. Right. And then we introduce randomness into the pacing before a virtual user starts doing another thing. So there are factors in our simulation that are going to make it hard to reproduce. So the idea of a lot of precision and four digits after the decimal point, I think, is maybe one of the not great things that's legacy things in performance testing. I think that running multiple tests is necessary, that you do need to understand what's going on to a certain extent. I try not to worry about chasing anything less than a 5 or 10% variance too far. I do want to understand if there's a variance, where it came from. And to finally get back to where you started, yes, I think you should run multiple tests. So 2 or 3 tests is typical for me. Sometimes it'll be a shakedown test where I just make sure everything's working. A baseline test where I run it, I don't know, 30% of peak and just kind of get what a response time should be. And then the 100% of the peak load model to see what occurs. And though with taking those measurements separately, I can at least test whether they all agree with each other or they're all plausible against each other. Running the exact same test multiple times, I have done that. So it can be expensive to run a load test depending on how many users you're simulating and how many people have to be on the conference call while you're doing it.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great advice. It's good to know that I was kind of doing the right thing. So, but now,
well, sure. I'd love to run 10 load tests on every project. It's just generally, you know, in testing, we always run out of time before we run out of things we could do to reduce risk.
Yeah, absolutely. And it goes back to, I was always afraid to give results early. So I would at least run three of them. So I didn't send out, for some reason, we're performance testing. It's so easy to start fires that with issues that aren't real issues because you could be using the tool wrong, putting a load on, making too many transactions that would never happen in a normal day. So I always got more confidence running it multiple times before I sent out results. So.
Oh, that's so key. You touched on some of the things we talked about before about your credibility.
Right.
And you know, once you've been wrong and you've gotten the person who works for that who works on that technology to chase some mirage that you created with your tool. I mean, it's going to be very difficult for people to pay attention to you next time. So what I used to like to do when I was a LoadRunner consultant was, okay, I saw this during the test. Don't hold me to it. I'll give you a full report in 24 to 48 hours. So I'd have time to assess what all the errors meant. And, you know, if I broke the system, make sure that I wasn't reporting anything that occurred after the system was broken. Making sure that I had changed the reporting window to after I'd reached peak load so that I didn't report the lower response times that happened when I was still ramping. And that kind of careful, thoughtful analysis is one of the things that Caviar is trying to overcome and not just do the tool jockey. Okay, I pushed play, and then I pushed generate report, and then I emailed it. I'm done.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think performance testing is almost an art, and it takes a lot of thinking and analyzing, like you said, rather than just, it's not just a tool. It really is a lot more going on than just, like you said, running a test, looking at the results. There's a lot that goes into it to make it, because once again, performance testing, for some reason, a lot of times once it goes into production, usually the results are totally different than what you've been working on for a few months. So,
Well, right, because something about the resources are going to be different.
Right.
You know, when I started, I mean, this is what happens when you begin in performance testing. Everybody wants to talk about tools.
Right.
Well, a fool with a tool is still a fool.
Yep.
And what I found by switching tools, you know, based on my context, is that the tools generally all do the same things. You know, their implementation might be slightly different, but it's a bit like different programming languages at different script languages. They all generally do the same things. It's all generally the same operations. It's just maybe different names for them and different methods. So focusing on what the tool does means that you're not adding any value. If all you do is operate a tool, then you should be replaced with a shell script.
So that's the whole point of automation. You may be able to automate something, but it's not necessarily doing the thinking that really needs to be involved in the process. Okay, Eric, before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their performance testing efforts? And let us know the best way to find out or contact you.
Okay, so the first one, I think the best way to improve your performance testing efforts is to take a step back and find somebody to take a look at what you're doing. I think that these projects turn into these multi-week, multi-month, multi-year things where you go down a rabbit hole and you're trying to build a certain test that may not necessarily be relevant to what your stakeholders want. It may not tell you what you think it's telling you. And I mean, in testing, it's really important to be able to focus and defocus. But when I look at where I've like really wasted time or the mistakes I really wish I could have back, it was, you know, it was spending, you know, 5% on planning and then a lot of time on executing and figuring out that I didn't spend enough time on planning. And then the second piece of advice I think is probably encapsulated when we were talking about the reporting is to not be a tool operator, or then you're just being a tool yourself. Be somebody who can understand what it is that the test is trying to determine or prove and be able to talk about the test results in that light, as opposed to I achieved so many transactions and this CPU percentage, and suddenly you've lost half the room that doesn't even follow what you're talking about anymore. The other half doesn't care. Always come back to the business requirement, and always come back to, you know, to what the real question is. Sometimes it's, do we go live or not? Sometimes it's, do we need to buy more hardware or not? But make sure you understand what that is and who's asking and how to communicate to them what they're looking to know. I have my full name, Eric Pregler, E-R-I-C-P-R-O-E-G-L-E-R, is my Twitter handle. I think that works for now. I don't want to broadcast my email address out into the whole world. LinkedIn, a lot of people have connected with me who I've never met. I don't mind that, but it's certainly a way that you can send me a message and I'd like to talk to you. And I'm really at a point in my career where I'm trying to help people out and volunteer and give something back, because there are an awful lot of people who gave me a helping hand and got me this far. It certainly isn't something where, you know, I just studied in monthly isolation for 15 years. It was taking help from people who are willing to give it to me, and I'm hoping to pass that forward.
Thank you, Eric, for your performance testing automation awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/80. And while you're there, make sure to click on the Sign Up Now button under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. And if this episode has helped you in any way, or you know someone that it could help, why not share it with a friend or coworker? And together, we can help spread automation awesomeness to the masses. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.